Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 7:54 a.m. and that is British Summer Time. And today is July 29th. It's Saturday. I would normally be recording on a Friday, but I thought I'd probably be better to give a better performance and do a better job if I got a good night's sleep first. And this is, of course, the big picture, long-term audio and various for the various different asset classes. So we have quite a few topics to cover today, but what I primarily want to focus on first is monetary policy and perhaps money supply would probably be a better way of thinking about it. And then on top of that, let's look at some of the accelerating trends, which look rather bubbly on Wall Street, and then also what might happen in the aftermath of that. And where the opportunities are likely to be going forward. So let's kick off with the JGB yield. It's up to 56 basis points. The Bank of Japan did a bit of a fudge, and we might just consider that not great communication. So they still officially have a reference rate for the yield curve control policy of 50 basis points. They said that they would also intervene and look at supporting the market around 75 basis points, and that they would buy unlimited quantities of JGBs at 1%. Well, that's rather messy. And what we are now seeing is that the JGB yield has popped on the upside, obviously, since they're not buying nearly as many at this current rate. And the first step above the base characteristic remains in place. So we have to give the benefit of the doubt to rising yields. And Japan has inflation. Now, it's a big question what they're doing right this time versus what they didn't do in the last or every other time they've tried it. I think that the fact that you have inflation everywhere else in the world and that Japan is doing exactly what everyone else had been doing during the pandemic is a good reason why inflation is rising. And we also know, of course, that input prices are rising or have risen all around the world. Their commitment to continue printing and to proceed and persist with doing so has been one of the major sources of liquidity for bull markets around the world as well. But I think we do need to look at lots of back history, because this is a really profound change. We've had JGB yields coming down now for an awfully long time, and this is a substantial breakout. So we haven't had a breakout like this that looked anything like this since at least 2003. And even then, the yield got up to 2% and was unable to surmount it. So then we had this low, well, I guess it's a long grind lower from 2008 all the way down to the lows in 2016. And I think it is important to highlight that yields did not exceed their lows back in 2019-20, and then subsequently have held a sequence of higher reaction lows over the last 3 years. So it's been this looming question in the markets for as long as I've been engaged in the markets about what's going to happen with the massive quantity of JGBs, because the Japanese government doesn't have enough money to actually make the payments. So I think we're probably going to get the answer to that over the course of the next decade. It looks like they fully intend to simply inflate it all away. And in normal circumstances, that would mean that there would be a weaker yen. But what we are definitely now seeing is something that could delay a weaker yen, which is that there's an awful lot of Japanese money that is sitting outside Japan and invested in higher yielding assets. Well, the higher yields go in Japan, then the greater the potential is that at least some of that money will start to come home. And that wave could potentially turn into a tsunami, and it could flood money back into the Japanese economy. So the yen is now sitting at 141. And we have to then, I think, pay attention to the kinds of moves that we're getting. So it strengthened for a day and then weakened on Friday. So the argument that all that money that's sitting offshore could come back and strengthen the currency, well, we didn't get much confirmation of that on Friday. And now the bigger question is, will the Bank of Japan need to do more? Will they need to completely abandon their yield curve control? The one thing, of course, that we can be pretty sure of is that they're sensitive to what happens with the yen. And if the yen weakens into this environment, well, it will, I think, probably give the Bank of Japan some pause. Because obviously they don't want to have a currency that accelerates lower in the short term. So there is a massive confidence game going on here. Japan needs the money. They would really want, they would like nothing more than to encourage all those assets home again and to support the economy. But in order to do that, they're going to have to ensure that there is some confidence in the JGB market. And that's very difficult to do when you stop buying. So we definitely know that quantitative tightening generally leads to a move higher in yields in the initial phases, because investors panic that the central bank is no longer buying the bonds. That's exactly what we had with the beginning of quantitative tightening in the USA and in Europe, where we had this huge run higher in yields all the way through, mostly 2022, and yields have basically been going sideways for the last 8 months. So there is the realistic possibility that if the yen doesn't, if the yen is not breaking higher and instead is weakening, then the Bank of Japan has basically failed to prevail upon Japanese investors to bring their assets home. And that means that yields could go quite a bit higher from here. And the chart looks like a first step above the base. Now, if we are looking at JGBs moving higher like everywhere else, then that's going to create problems for the Japanese government because they don't have the cash. They have got a bigger hole in their budget from interest rate expense than just about every other country because of their massive debt-to-GDP ratio. But with a weakening yen, that also means that the carry trade will continue. And now let's just look at the Nikkei. So the Nikkei was down a little on Friday, but it's still holding this break above the 30,000 level. We have this sequence of ranges, one above the last, and the pace of the advance has not really picked up just yet because 5,000 point increments have been quite normal during this entire trend. In fact, we have four ranges, one above the last, and that really began in 2012 with the initial devaluation of the currency. Now the Nikkei is approaching the peaks from back in 1989 and looks quite a bit more or better supported on this occasion. It's been really quite a long time since there was a big secular bull on the Japanese market. But usually secular bulls are accompanied by a stronger domestic currency as well. So we're definitely getting the nominal price appreciation in Japan, and that is being reflected in the hedged performance. So obviously, when we think then about where the potential is, there are two very big potential outcomes, which could have significant knock-on effects for the rest of the world. If Japan can successfully encourage all that Japanese investor capital back from around the world, well, then that should help to stabilize the currency. But probably, I think it is more likely that that's the long-term potential outcome. And the short-term potential outcome is that the yen goes down first and that yields go up first. And yields go up to a sufficiently attractive level that they become competitive with yields around the world. Then you'll start to see some external demand coming in for Japanese assets. And that would perhaps encourage some of the money home. Because the one thing we have to remember is that Japanese investors know their domestic market better than anyone. And they're obviously not impressed by the miscommunications that are coming through. So that would suggest that the most likely scenario is that the yield curve control program is going to turn into a debacle, and then that yields will move higher from here, and that the carry trade in the yen will get an additional boost. So that's an important source of risk capital for the financial markets. Now let's think about, well, where is the market that has been benefiting most from risk capital around the world? And we have the Nasdaq approaching the 16,000 point level. And it has been really quite orderly on the upside over the course of the last 6 months. And it is now somewhat overextended relative to the 200-day moving average and back in a region of previous resistance around that 16,000 level. So it's a good time to start thinking about, well, what happens next? I don't think it's unreasonable to think that we should get at least a pause in consolidation, and so perhaps a pause that lasts more than 2 or 3 days. If we look at the trend higher since March of this year, we've had these very tight little ranges, one above the last, and that's an exceptionally benign scenario. So we've definitely had a bullish environment, and now approaching the 16,000 level, it's reasonable that we could get a lengthier period of consolidation. We definitely saw a lengthier pause in February all the way through to the middle of March, and that was about 1,000 points in amplitude. So far, the ranges over the course of the last 5 months have been more like 500-point amplitude ranges. Now, when we think about valuation, well, the PE is at 32 on the historic, and I think that's a generous way of looking at it. When I think about Tesla, we've had lots of talk about electric cars in the media recently. But the thing that I think is most interesting is we've had this phenomenal rebound, and that rebound has been basically, and I will just zoom in, that the PE for Tesla was at what might be considered a conservative level of about 33 in December, and now it's 75. So the price at the same time has gone from about 100 to 260. So not all of the doubling in the PE has been valuation expansion, but a lot of it has. And when we think then about earnings, well, they're definitely selling more cars. Are they selling enough cars to justify their valuation? That's another question. But it's still trending on the upside. And Tesla has been one of the primary destinations for hot money over the course of the last 15 years. So it is a clear responder to that. And at least the share is holding the rebound, and by doing so, unwinding some of the short-term overbought condition. Now, the more we zoom in, though, we can see that we had a weekly downside key reversal last week and some barely or steady action this week. So I still don't think that it is all clear here, that we have really quite overbought conditions in the short term, that it is more likely than not, just on the balance of probabilities, that we will get a pause in consolidation, even if we are still in a bullish environment overall. Now, it's I think important then to also think about what else is going on out there in the world. And I do think that the dollar index is far and away the most important trend in the world right now. If the dollar can extend a rebound break back above 105, well, then that would really confirm that we have a soft landing scenario in the USA, that the USA has come through the pandemic and the subsequent unwinding of massive excessive stimulus better than any other country, and that justifies having a stronger currency and a stronger stock market, even if we have tighter monetary conditions. And the primary argument for a soft landing is that it was really just an anomaly, that we had the big pop on the upside in terms of monetary accommodation. Taking it back out again is more like disinflation. And once that has been complete, we can just get back to trend and continue. And the stronger that markets go, the longer that they stay in the region of peaks and exceeding their peaks, then the more adherence there will be for that particular view. So what happens now for the dollar is rather important. Now, back in early 2022, a subscriber reminded me yesterday that I thought it would be one and done, and that the Federal Reserve would raise rates once and that they wouldn't be able to get off the zero bound. And the reason that I thought that is because of the interest expense and the ability of the US government to fund itself. But they were able to get off the zero bound, and they did raise rates and continue to raise rates in an aggressive manner. So how were they able to do that when the size of the deficit has been rather stubborn? Well, one thing was tax receipts. So the US government had a big boom in tax receipts as consumer activity picked up in the aftermath of the financial crisis. And I underestimated that. And I think this was a really good chart I saw this week, and where it highlights that lots of countries actually still have precautionary savings, and the UK has some of the highest. People are really worried about the trajectory of the economy, and they're not willing to put risk capital to work. But in the USA, the household excess savings have retreated really quite substantially. And this gets back to, some of the truisms in the market, that people are pretty safe in concluding. And one of those is that when US consumers have money, they will spend it. And that has also been one of the primary drivers of the recovery. And it allowed the Federal Reserve to continue raising rates because consumers had the ability to take the hit to their purchasing power in terms of inflation, and did not need to go out and borrow a lot because a lot of people were able to lock in 30-year mortgages during the pandemic. So now we're in a situation where the excess savings have dropped from over 6% to less than 2% and are still contracting. So when we think then about the conclusion that the US government wouldn't be able to fund itself because of the rising interest expense and the potential for a recession, well, perhaps that's a better argument now than it was at the beginning of 2022, because a lot of the excess and precautionary savings have been eroded. And I think that's something that we definitely need to pay attention to, because we are in a tight monetary environment, and Japan is the only place that is still printing. And even there, they're beginning to think about how they can stop doing it, because they want inflation. And I guess the other important point, of course, is demographics. Japan lost 800,000 people last year. And that wasn't because of some massive natural disaster or a war. It's simply that their replacement rate is so low. So I've been thinking a lot about this particular question over the last several years. What is it in a country that promotes a high birth rate? And most particularly within a developed country where the access to the contraceptives of whatever form is freely available. Well, we've definitely seen that as developed countries have progressed, their birth rates have declined in line with economic activity and female participation in the workforce. And my sister, for example, is I was spending a few days with her in Dublin over the last few days, and she was complaining about how having children simply by taking the maternity leave, that the woman becomes the default parent. And after that, then flexible work arrangements are necessary, and it's more difficult to progress up the career ladder. So that, I think, is part of it, that women then are fully aware of that the issues that arise from taking a couple of years out to raise children when they're very young. And then, of course, the problems with childcare that come immediately after that, and how much it costs and where the money is going to come from to actually pay for it. So they just decide either not to have children or have fewer. So it really comes down to both an attitude towards the future, and then also it's going to be a money question. So Hungary has deployed some radical policies to try and promote the birth rate, and they have been largely successful. But what it has amounted to is basically giving mothers a massive tax break. And it is incredibly attractive. And the more children you have, the more attractive the payments are. And having a tax-free life for your entire lifetime after having several children is certainly attractive to entrepreneurial-type people, because they can go off and start a business. But then let's also think about the fact that the USA has typically had a higher birth rate than other developed countries, and so has Ireland. And now that might be partly cultural, and that people put more value in children just from a cultural perspective. But then there's also the potential, I think, that housing in the USA, for example, with 30-year mortgages, is more manageable, and you can have a surety about what your payment is going to be. And because you're locking it in a mildly inflationary environment, then you are coming out positive in real terms with your mortgage payment. And that basically removes a big uncertainty for a lot of homeowners. And with removal of uncertainty, then they can think about the kinds of things they want to do with their lives, which in one of the things that people would like to do is to have children. So if you have a sunnier, more optimistic view about the outcome, then perhaps it is easier to have children. And what, of course, that suggests about Japan is that after decades of deflation, where people have had to take a death by a thousand cuts diminution of their living standards, then it's obviously something that has got into the national psyche, that you don't buy today because it might be higher or better tomorrow, but rather you Delay. You delay the purchases because prices might be better later. But of course, what that also means is you delay having children because you need to have a better financial situation later. And the longer and longer that people delay the situation, then the reality is you just end up with less children. So I think what happens in Japan in over the next several decades, and particularly in terms of the bond market and the currency markets and the stock market, is going to be especially interesting because it will give us a picture of perhaps not so much what will happen in the Western world, but it certainly gives us a picture of what we might expect in parts of Asia, because there's I think a strong cultural affinity in terms of thinking about the future, thinking about the welfare of children and the cost of rearing children and the sacrifices that families are willing to make in order to get that done. Now, when then we think about this particular question about household savings, well, US consumers will spend when they have the cash, and they have been spending. And the dollar index is now rebounding from the region of the 100 level. And 100 was a meaningful area of resistance between 2015 and 2021. And now it's acting as an area of support. So we've had a good size rebound to unwind the short term oversold. But the sequence of lower rally highs remains intact. And at the bond market is now front and center. So there's a big short position right now in the 10-year yield. Now, I think the time to be really short of the 10-year was in March of 2020. And we've seen yields go from 50 basis points to almost 450 basis points in the space of little more than 3 years. So now the yield is back testing the 4% level, and then had a good jump on Wednesday following the Fed decision. And the Fed decision really didn't say anything, but markets are beginning to parse through what it all means, because inflation is coming down, at least in the way that the Fed measures it. And the bond yield has been stable for the last 8 months. So it's still hovering here around the 4% level and holding the breakout from the longer term range. So we're really at the do or die moment here. Either yields are going to progress from here and move north in a rhythmic fashion as the trend progresses, or this lengthier range following the acceleration in the middle of 2022 is top formation. And we're going to see the yield pull back down and test the 1,000-day moving average, which would be a fairly substantial rally. But I don't think that we're going to see yields come all the way back down to the lows. I think that when we look at the full faith that people are willing to put in governments these days, then their willingness to spend and whatever it takes to try and ensure that they retain power. That's obviously something that bond investors have to pay attention to. And what they have been doing is demanding a higher yield. So I think that what we would have to see is a deflationary shock, and I think that it is quite likely we will. So when we look at the core services, less housing, that is one of the measures that the Federal Reserve is paying attention to. Now it is coming down, but it's not coming down very fast. And they want to get this back down around the 2% level, and it's double their target right now. So the more history we look at, then we can see that there have been times when it is back around the 2% level, but it doesn't spend a lot of time there. And I think it's more correct to say that they've been targeting a 3% level, or a 3% hurdle, for PCE core services less housing. So there's clearly the potential that it's going to surprise on the downside at some stage, and that the Federal Reserve will continue raising rates until they get a clear signal that they can't do that anymore. So, what is the signal that would stop them from raising rates? Well, I think one would be a big decline on the stock market. That would certainly be problematic. And then a second one would be a big jump in unemployment. Well, we definitely don't have that right now. The number of people that are in jobs continues to increase. So I think that's certainly something that is out there in the future. But it will happen eventually, that you cannot simply raise rates as aggressively as they have done without there being any negative consequences. It's only the I think the main point is that there was so much money lying around in 2022 that it just absorbed the pressure from raising rates. The thing that I am basing that conclusion that we are likely to have a deflationary shock is that is what we've had during other periods of time where we've had quantitative tightening. So between 2018 and 19, we had a big contraction in the size of the Fed's balance sheet, about $750 billion. And that by the time we got to 2019, there was that front cover of The Economist with the dead T-Rex saying, has inflation become extinct? So perhaps now we're at this same kind of situation because the size of the Fed's balance sheet has come in by about $750 billion. That's exactly what happened in 2018 and 19, but it's coming down from a much higher level. So it might have to come down by double that number in order to have the same effect. So the deflation is a future issue rather than a current issue. And I think that's quite clearly a response to the just the sheer volume of cash that has been printed over the last couple of years. And I think we can just see that if we look at M2. Because some people have been panting about the fact that the growth in M2 has gone negative for the first time. But it's still going up. And that it's only just barely started to come down. So the supply of M2 is at almost, well, it's at 19.4 trillion. And it's never really come down. And we see that big pop on the upside in the middle of 2020. And now we're in this environment where we have a lot of money that has been created. There's a lot of speculation about where that money is eventually going to reside and how much of it is going to get spent around the place. So as we think then about where are we in this situation? Well, M2 never goes down. We've never seen a situation where it has contracted in a meaningful fashion. And in fact, there have only been occasions when it has just gone sideways and come back to trend over a long period of time. So it's not like the money is going to come out of the system entirely. Even with the Federal Reserve reducing the size of its balance sheet, the just the volume of cash in the system isn't something that's going to disappear overnight. So we're still in this environment where we get the bigger move on the upside, because this is very consistent with what we see during an inverted yield curve. And I think that it is very relevant that we have three phases of an inverted yield curve. The first, at the beginning, is that people are worried about inflation. And finally, the central bank reacts and they raise interest rates, and that creates the inverted yield curve. And everybody then worries that there's going to be a recession. And But at the same time, the acts to get inflation under control are effective. So then inflationary measures start to come back down. People worry less about the lead indicator of the recession and rejoice at inflation coming back down. So they re-engage with the market. So then you go into the second phase where you get a big rally. And we've seen big rallies following inversions on several occasions. The initial inversion in 1998, it was very mild. But that was the period of time between 98 and 2000 when the NASDAQ went up most. Then in 2005, we had the initial inversion. And between the time when the yield curve fully first went inverted and then started to trend higher up through zero, well, then the market went up substantially and the housing market just went sideways. And of course, we had then this incredible advance in assets like commodities and gold, because that was the focus of investor attention at the time. Well, then everything was fast forwarded in 2019. We had a mild inversion in 2019. The market continued higher. Central banks were already raising rates. Valuations were stretched. And then we had the pandemic and a ton of money was printed. So it was looking likely there was going to be a recession in 2019 just because of all the positioning. Then we had the pandemic and it fast forwarded everything. So we got the recession and then we got the recovery. But now we have this deep inverted yield curve and we've had a big rebound. And now the bigger question is, how deep is this inversion going to go and what will be required for it to turn around? So we had Jay Powell in here this week basically saying that they don't want to cut interest rates. They're going to hold interest rates at elevated levels for a substantial period of time and that not to bet on interest rates coming down this year or potentially even in 2024. So the inverted yield curve now is about as inverted as it was back in the late 1970s and early 1980s. So to say that we've had a big move in yields is not exactly a profound statement. This has been a huge move in yields. And eventually, it's going to contribute to a hiccup. And there are a couple of different ways of looking at this. And this was another way I thought was interesting this week. So you look at the conference board consumer expectations versus current conditions. And every time it gets below the negative 50 level, we have a recession. And we had that again in 2019, and we're back there now. So there's lots of lead indicators, lots of things that people have historically looked at to predict recessions, and they all point now towards time for caution, that this is not a time for taking big risks. This is a time for being particularly diligent about where stops are. And I think that's pretty much where we are right now. So we've had these phenomenal moves in several stock markets, and this is quite normal. This is exactly what you get during the second phase of the inverted yield curve, and you get these big runs on the upside. It's exactly the time when bubbly conditions take over. Now we've had a big move in bullish positioning in the options market. And we still have a big short position in the bond market. And there has been a mania evolving around artificial intelligence. And NVIDIA is one of the biggest beneficiaries of that. Now, at the counterpoint to all of those statements is that the number of people using ChatGPT is actually going down. That All the other companies that want to get a piece of artificial intelligence are now designing their own chips, and people will soon remember that NVIDIA doesn't manufacture any of its own chips, that it uses contract manufacturers like Taiwan Semiconductor, and anybody can do that. So you have companies like Apple and Google and Microsoft designing their own artificial intelligence chips, and as soon as they go into production, well, they're not going to have to buy from NVIDIA anymore. And of course, then NVIDIA also has this, let's just call it a fudge, where they downpower some of their chips, so they have to, so the potential buyer, namely China, has to buy twice as many of them to achieve the same computing power. So they've boosted sales by skirting sanctions and doing so in a regulatory arbitrage type of way, and that has certainly benefited the share, where it has gone from 100 to 500 in less than a year. So that's an incredible performance. Now, when we look at the Fangman companies relative to the total market cap of the NYSE, well, we're presented with an incredible rebound over the last 6 months, and it closed at a new high on Friday. And I think it is reasonable to conclude that this bull market will not end until this ratio breaks lower. And it did look like it was breaking lower at the end of 2022, and it has subsequently rebounded. And now you have 8 companies representing 24.16% of the total market, or at least according to the chart, rather than the way that it's reported on the headline for Google, not for Bloomberg. So this has been a picture also of how much of the performance of the stock market has depended on those 7 companies. So we can think about NVIDIA and the potential that it could double, it could go to 1,000 in a bubbly environment where people are not thinking about the challenges and only thinking that they need to get a way of leveraging access to the boom in artificial intelligence, then NVIDIA can attract flow. There's no question of that. But it's expensive, and the trend is way overextended. So the first big downward dynamic is going to be a peak of at least near-term, potentially medium-term significance. And then subsequently, one has to be particularly vigilant around stops. Now let's just think about other companies. And we've had plenty that have gone through these really dire problems with legal responsibility. And 3M this week popped on the upside, and it is now testing the region of the 200-day moving average for the first time in about 8 months. And we're back in the region of lows that haven't been seen since around 2013. So it's potentially at the point where it can tackle some of its liability for forever chemicals. And that is something that could help to support the market. Then Bayer has basically become the global seed company and has had significant liability because of its exposure to Monsanto. But then it got all of Monsanto's assets at the same time. It's now basically the global behemoth in terms of the seed and food market, and the share is steadying from the lower side of this evolving base formation, and there is a very mild sequence of higher reaction lows within that base. And as we think then about the potential here, well, I'm just highlighting these two companies to say that not every stock is at at extraordinary valuations or trending higher, that we have plenty of well-established companies that have gone through periods of difficulty and have some visibility as to what recovery might begin to look like. And when we think about where value comes from, well, we can have value from growth companies because they create something out of nothing. And that is certainly promoted by the low interest rate environment, where investors are losing out because of low interest rates, so they're more amenable to investing. But most particularly, risk takers can get access to capital for free, and then they get to speculate at a very low cost, and it helps to inflate asset prices. And that then ensures that you do get a big move higher, and they can create something out of nothing. You get new products and you get new methods. And the fact that, for example, today SpaceX was able to use the Falcon Heavy to bring a satellite into orbit. Well, we've seen plenty of occasions where they've intentionally blown that rocket up, and now it's in service. So the pace of innovation in space travel is nothing short of breathtaking, and it is a brand new arena for investment and for profits. And that wouldn't, I don't think that would have happened without the low interest rate environment helping to make vast sums of cash available to simply throw away on a science project. So that's where we have real value created, that technology and people working in labs and people who are really passionate about the science, they are going to be working one way or another, that they're going to do what they do. The process through which commercialization happens and how companies evolve out of science projects and then reach commercial utility, that's something that requires access to cash, and it relies on funding and the willingness of private capital and public capital to commit funds. And that is something that is very tied to the interest rate cycle. So technology tends to follow the interest rate cycle. Now, on this particular occasion, we have companies that have got hundreds of billions in cash, and they can basically fund whatever they want. But their customers can't. And when interest rates go up, then customers start to have problems. Now, when your customers are having issues, well, then your business has issues. And that's not something that your, I guess, your cash pile will ensure you survive. But it doesn't mean that you will thrive. You have to then focus entirely on trying to capture market share. And I think that is the concentration effect that we're going to have within the technology sector. There will be big companies buying smaller companies. The fact that Microsoft has is increasingly likely to successfully buy Activision is a good example of how a big company can buy a what would have been, I think it's even today, it's probably more correct to say how a huge company is now buying a big company, because I don't think we can justifiably say that a company worth $80 billion is a small company. Now, as we then think about this trend of what's happening with the stock market, let's also pay attention to the fact that oil prices have popped on the upside. Now, Brent crude had been going sideways, and as long as that trend was intact and it was ranging below the 1,000-day moving average, I was willing to give the benefit of the doubt to the downside. And now it is breaking on the upside. So the fact that the Federal Reserve came out on Wednesday and said that their internal economists no longer anticipate a recession, then that was bullish. And with growth remaining steady and inflation coming down, that suggests higher demand. And oil prices are really finally balanced right now because OPEC has been quite diligent in cutting supply. So anything that improves the outlook for global demand is certainly helping the price to appreciate. But of course, higher energy prices contribute to inflation. And inflation means that interest rates stay higher for longer. So it's a bit of a catch-22 situation, and we definitely have a little bit of a market paradox. But as long as oil prices are going higher, then that's going to contribute to energy prices moving higher. It's going to be more expensive to produce food. And then we're also going to have a feedback loop into wage demand growth, because the importance of gasoline is that people see it every day, and they know what they paid for it last week, and they know what they feel comfortable paying for it. That's something that doesn't really factor into how inflation is measured, but it certainly factors into how people feel inflation. And gasoline prices popped on the upside in here this week as well, and are now testing the $3 level. So we're also in an area, or we're in a point where the USA no longer has its strategic reserve. There's a limit to how much they can take out of it, because a lot of that oil is stored in underground caverns. And how much of it they can take out is not just a factor of what they want, but it's a geological question. So this would suggest that the market is in a tighter situation now than it was back in early 2022, and that there isn't a big source of non-OPEC new supply that can be simply brought onto market with little fuss. So there is the potential that we're going to have an inflationary move from the oil market, and an oil shock. Well, that is something that is one of the causal factors behind a recession. So we definitely need to pay attention to that. And what's particularly interesting at present is that the oil companies were in negative territory on Thursday, because some of the big companies like Exxon and Shell, they reported lower profits. But a rising oil price makes the future potential for profits look better. So the XLE, or the energy spider, is bouncing now from the region of the 200-day moving average. And it has been a serious loss of momentum over the last year, because the profits from the pandemic were unsustainable. Now the big question is, will oil prices improve from here? And it certainly looks like they will. Now, natural gas, on the other hand, is contracting. And we've had a meaningful drop down from the 3% level, excuse me, the $3 level in natural gas. And this remains a picture of excess supply. So we are in an environment where there's no shortage of natural gas, and there will be new sources of demand. So as we think then about where are we going? Well, the big trend that the commodity complex is promoting is electrification, and that there will be a lot more EVs on the market, and there will be a massive change in how we heat our food. Victoria in Australia yesterday announced that they're not going to allow any gas connections for new builds for homes. And that's following on from a policy that failed to really make a dent in gas demand in California. This also suggests is that there will have to be greater investment in transmission cables and in electricity generating capacity. We're perhaps already seeing that in the pressure that grids are coming under during the summer months. And that's not simply about climate change. It's perhaps more a reflection of the fact that there's a lot more EVs on the market and that a greater percentage of the population in several countries are moving to the warmer parts. And that's creating demand for air conditioning, which is incredibly electricity intensive. So there's going to have to be greater investment in utilities. And that means that there's going to have to be higher rates from utility providers in order to fund that construction. And the upward pressure on yields is continuing to weigh on the sector. So the utility sector has got a lot of spending in front of it and will have to borrow money at higher levels than they've had to for years. And there is the real potential that there will be blackouts. And that's a fact that, or I guess that's something that could affect lots of different countries because the trend towards electrification proceeds. Of course, what it also means is that the major oil companies have been reluctant to invest in new oil supply because they're worried that they'll just be investing in stranded assets. So prices have to go up meaningfully in order to encourage new supply. And of course, what that also contributes to is tighter conditions. When energy prices go higher and stay high, and when there is an inability to enhance supply, then that's something that will contribute to less demand eventually. And less demand means less economic activity. We can see what's happening in Germany right now, where economic activity is moderating and the economy is moving into a recession. That's as much about the slow pace of the recovery in China as it is about the tight monetary conditions that we have in Germany, and then obviously the low ebb of the Rhine is also impacting transportation of goods out of the main industrial heartland. And I think this is also a reflection of the drive towards electrification. And what we're definitely seeing is that the political will to get it done is very clear. And that this is not so much about the environment, although that is how it is being sold. It's about national security. And when you recast electrification in terms of national security, then it makes a lot more sense. And I think that is something that will help to promote investment in utilities over time. And they're unlikely to be the best places to park capital simply because they're going to be chewing up capital to build that new capacity. It's when the building programs have reached their end destination and there's visibility on when the spending will end, that's when the share prices will recover in a more meaningful fashion. So we still have some inflationary pressures out there, and consumers are beginning to get into more of an inflationary mindset. And that's the primary reason why I don't think we're going to see yields compress all the way back down to 1% or even to negative levels like we had in the run-up to the pandemic. There are still inflationary issues out there, and the inability of governments to fund themselves, and the social distress that it causes when they try to patch the holes in their spending, like France has been doing, and the desire to try and ensure that pensions can be paid for by having people work a little longer. and the kinds of protests that that is eliciting, that's just a foretaste of what we're going to see in lots of other countries where the pension funding issues are worse. And then, of course, that is really why we do need to pay attention to what's happening in Japan. Because if they can't control their yield on their government bonds, and the government is in no way prepared to, are in a position to meet the interest payments, well, then they will have little choice than to embrace inflation and erode living standards, but meet the nameplate payments. That's a real possibility. And what it also means is that one does have to think about where the benefit is going to come from. What are the assets that would do well in that scenario? Well, gold prices are still steady in the region of the 200-day moving average. There's been a 3-year range underway. It's been a long period of time where it's been ranging in the region of the peak from back in 2011. And so far, this has been a reasonably consistent consolidation. It does require the dollar to trend downwards, and most particularly that the trend of real rates turns downwards as well. And we had a failed upside break on the real yield 2 weeks ago, but it did steady again this week. If, or I don't think it's an if, but it's a when, this index starts to trend downwards. That is generally consistent with the times when gold does best. It's not so much that gold needs negative real rates, but that the trend of real rates needs to be falling in order to stimulate demand for an asset that doesn't have a yield. Now, as we think about the trend overall of the dollar, maybe we do get a soft landing. I think that it is that reaching that conclusion now is exceptionally risky. And I think that it is more likely that the long sweep of cyclicality in the dollar points towards a weaker dollar over time. And that will then encourage assets away from the US market. What I think is most particularly relevant is that there's a lot of people that are promoting the exceptionally low valuation of commodities relative to the stock market, and saying that that is evidence of that we're going to have a secular bull market in commodities. But we can look at the same ratios for US versus ex-US markets, or value versus growth. They all have these exceptionally low ratio points because of the massive overvaluation of the technology sector in the USA. So we're not going to see the bull market on Wall Street end until that dominance of the mega caps ends too. And we're not going to see a big new emerging market and commodity-led bull market until we see the dollar trending downwards. We need to see that because big international investors, they want the currency, the interest rate, and the market on their side. And if they can get the government on their side, even better. Countries like India and Mexico, Vietnam, South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, what they're trying to do is tread a safe path through the behemoths like the USA and China. I think that ex-US, or the Nifty index, has done really fantastically well. Ex-US assets are likely to outperform over the lengthy medium term for many markets that have gone through a long period of underperformance. Now, India's capital market appreciation relative to China has been really quite spectacular. But China is cheap, and eventually the Chinese government is going to have to engage in additional stimulus. And there is increasing potential that that is what is underway. So the H-share index is firming from the 6,000 level. And it ranged below 12,000 for most of the time between 2018 and 2021. So there's certainly the potential that we could get a reversionary rally. Now, it's been a very long range, and we've seen very depressed levels over the course of the last year. And that got all the way back down to test the lows from 2008. And the market could easily rally if there is an additional stimulus. And if the government rolls in and says that they're going to backstop the property developers, then that would certainly help to encourage bullish demand. India will outperform over the long term, but there will be times when China outperforms India. And we might be looking at one of those right now. Now, the thing about China, of course, is that it's a trader's market. The political volatility isn't something that's easy to predict. So there will be times when it does well, and that will be when the government is sponsoring the bull market. And the times when the government is not sponsoring the bull market, well, then one is really better off just taking money and getting out. And I think that is certainly something that has contributed to this exceptionally volatile ranging environment. And there's nothing to say that that ranging environment is going to change anytime soon. But we are at the lower side of the range. So there is certainly the potential that China will be one of the better emerging market markets over the course of the next year and potentially longer. But even then, it's still a highly risky place to leave money for the long term. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.